Hello and welcome to the June 16th, 2026 Annals of Internal Medicine podcast. I'm Dr. Christine Lane, Annals Editor-in-Chief, and I'm here to give you a quick rundown on the new articles that are waiting for you on annals.org. The first articles I want to highlight are the American College of Physicians Clinical Guideline on the Pharmacological Treatment of Obesity, the Supporting Evidence Reviews, and an accompanying editorial by several of Annals editors. Evidence-based clinical guidance on obesity treatment is critically important. Overweight and obesity reduce life expectancy and increase the likelihood of weight-related comorbidities such as hypertension, type 2 diabetes, hyperlipidemia, and cancer. Globally, among adults, 59% have overweight or obesity. In the U.S., 34% of U.S. adults are estimated to be overweight, and 34% are estimated to have obesity. Despite the availability of weight loss interventions, patients remain undertreated, likely because of availability and access issues. The economic burden of overweight and obesity is also very high. As the prevalence of obesity continues to increase, the World Obesity Federation has estimated the global impact of overweight and obesity as a result of higher healthcare costs and lost economic productivity will exceed $4.3 trillion in 2035. The ACP Clinical Guidelines Committee based the recommendations on systematic reviews of the pharmacologic treatments in adults with overweight or obesity and used the grading of recommendations, assessment, development, and evaluation approach. I will briefly summarize the recommendations here and encourage you to go to annals.org for the background and rationale behind this guidance. Recommendation 1. The ACP suggests initiating one of the following pharmacologic treatments with lifestyle modifications for weight management in non-pregnant adults with obesity, defined here as body mass index greater than or equal to 30 kilograms per meter squared. First-line treatments include semaglutide and tirzepatide, supported by moderate certainty evidence. Second-line treatment is phentermine topiramate, supported by low certainty evidence, and liraglutide and naltrexone bupropion are recommended as third-line treatment options supported by low certainty evidence. Recommendation 2. ACP suggests initiating one of the following pharmacologic treatments with lifestyle modifications for weight management in non-pregnant adults with overweight, defined as body mass index 27 to 30 kilograms per meter squared, and type 2 diabetes, dyslipidemia, hypertension, obstructive sleep apnea, or cardiovascular disease. ACP recommends semaglutide or tirzepatide as first-line options based on moderate certainty evidence. Recommended second-line treatment is liraglutide based on low certainty evidence. ACP advises that when initiating a recommended medication for weight management or switching to another recommended medication because of an inadequate response, clinicians and patients should discuss benefits, harms, costs, access and availability, clinical comorbidities, weight loss goals, life expectancy, values and preferences, and contraindications. For example, uncertain safety during early pregnancy, the requirement for monthly pregnant tests with the use of phentermine topiramate, the contraindication for phentermine topiramate in those with cardiovascular disease, and the contraindication of naltrexone bupropion for those with a history of suicidal ideation. In an accompanying editorial, Annals editors note that glucagon-like peptide 1 receptor agonists, including multi-receptor agonists, have renewed attention on pharmacotherapy to treat obesity. With respect to the supporting evidence reviews, the editorialists highlight the Herculean task of wading through vast data. They also explain why making sense of this evidence is even more complicated. While randomized clinical trials abound, head-to-head trials comparing obesity medications remain sparse. They discuss the cautions related to interpretation of the available indirect evidence and gaps that future research should address. And staying on the topic of GLP-1 receptor agonists, the next article reports a target trial emulation that examined the risks associated with GLP-1 receptor agonist exposure in early pregnancy. Researchers analyzed insurance claims from 3,572 pregnancies between 2011 and 2024, comparing continuation of GLP-1 receptor agonists into the first trimester, defined as one or more pharmacy dispensations after conception relative to non-continuation. The findings showed similar risks for non-live birth, abnormal fetal growth, or major congenital malformation between pregnant persons that were dispensed GLP-1 receptor agonists after conception and those who were not. As GLP-1 receptor agonist use among women of reproductive age becomes more prevalent, these observations offer some reassurance for pregnant women with unintentional first trimester exposure to these drugs. However, estimates were imprecise, particularly for rarer outcomes like major congenital malformations and small size for gestational age at birth. So the authors call for further research to better understand the safety of GLP-1 receptor agonists in pregnancy. Hospitalization can be challenging for persons with dementia. Hospital stays can exacerbate cognitive impairment and risk iatrogenic complications. To examine the clinical and financial outcomes associated with hospital admission for persons with dementia, the next study reported examined more than 870,000 emergency department visits by Medicare fee-for-service beneficiaries aged 66 years or older with dementia between 2017 and 2019. Of these visits, a little over half resulted in hospital admission. The researchers compared mortality, additional hospital days, and spending over the next 90 days between the two groups, accounting for differences in severity of illness. They found no clear difference in survival or subsequent hospitalization. However, not surprisingly, patients who were admitted to the hospital had significantly higher healthcare costs. The findings suggest that healthcare spending could be reduced without compromising health outcomes by avoiding hospitalization for some patients with dementia who present to the emergency department. Unfortunately, the study was unable to assess quality of life or cognitive outcomes associated with hospitalization. Dementia is also the topic of the next article. Studies have suggested a protective association between herpes zoster vaccination and dementia, but these studies have had methodological limitations or examined a live attenuated vaccine no longer available in the U.S. Researchers conducted a target trial emulation to examine whether older adults previously unvaccinated with recombinant herpes zoster vaccine, recently admitted for post-acute or long-term care, who received the vaccine within 12 months of entering the facility, have a lower risk of developing dementia over up to 4 years of follow-up than those who did not receive the vaccine. Data included Medicare claims linked to nursing home electronic health record data. Receipt of recombinant herpes zoster vaccine was associated with a 5.8 lower risk of dementia. These data add to growing evidence that recombinant herpes zoster vaccination may offer some protection from dementia. Older adults often have impaired physiologic reserve and are at higher risk of postoperative complications. Prehabilitation is increasingly being used to maximize patients' functional status prior to surgery. Next is a randomized trial that evaluated the efficacy of 4 weeks of multimodal prehabilitation plus a program to enhance recovery after surgery versus the enhanced recovery program alone on 90-day postoperative complications in 164 adults 75 years and older undergoing elective spinal fusion in China. Just under 75% of patients in the prehabilitation group experienced at least one postoperative complication, compared to just over 91% of patients randomized to the postoperative recovery program alone. These findings suggest a benefit of prehabilitation for older persons undergoing elective spinal surgery. However, individual sites will need to consider applicability of findings and resource requirements of prehabilitation prior to implementation. Study about the effectiveness of prehabilitation before other surgical procedures is also needed. Go to annals.org to read the article, which provides details about the prehabilitation intervention. Access to healthcare in non-metropolitan areas of the U.S. is a topic of current concern. To shed additional light on this issue, researchers analyzed data from a large nationally representative survey to compare healthcare workforce levels in metropolitan and non-metropolitan areas. The sample included 588,489 respondents who were actively employed healthcare workers between 2019 to 2023. The researchers calculated workforce size relative to workplace urbanicity. The study found that non-metropolitan areas had about 44% fewer healthcare workers per 10,000 residents, with the biggest gap seen in roles requiring more advanced training, including psychologists, physicians, and surgeons. These findings suggest that workforce shortages in non-urban areas are widespread and affect both the number and types of providers available, which may contribute to differences in health outcomes. In a new Annals Beyond the Guidelines, two hematologists who co-authored the 2025 Iron Consortium Guideline discussed that they would diagnose, evaluate, and manage iron deficiency anemia in a patient whose symptoms and test results fall into areas of clinical uncertainty. Their discussion highlights differences in approach to testing thresholds, the role of gastrointestinal evaluation, and when to use oral versus intravenous iron, drawing on recent guidelines and evolving evidence. Go to annals.org to watch the video of the grand rounds, read the article, and earn CME and MOC credit. The topic of this month's In the Clinic review is hypertension. Go to annals.org to refresh your knowledge about this very common condition, and there's another opportunity to earn CME and MOC credit. That brings us to the end of this podcast. Thanks for listening, and thanks to Beth Jenkinson, Andrew Langman, and Bernie Turner for their technical support.